Okay, we're going to continue in Matthew chapter 5. We're going to back up and just review one section briefly just to give us a context of where we are, because this is a part tour here of what we did last week. So just a real quick review, and then we'll move into tonight's topic, which, in my estimation, the second half of Matthew chapter 5 is probably the most difficult section in the Sermon on the Mount for me, because of what it instructs. My knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, he couldn't possibly mean that, which is always dangerous when you read a verse in the Bible and say, well, he couldn't mean that, could he? So it is a challenge to read it, because I always want to put disclaimers on it. So tonight, I'm going to try to not put any more disclaimers than I have to on it. You're going to want me to before we're done, because it is a difficult set of instructions on how to love people who are not loving you back, among other things. So just by way of review, this section on the Sermon on the Mount was introduced in verses 17 through 20, where Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." So we talked just generally that Jesus, and the language of the ESV, is not abolishing the law. So it's not going anywhere. It's still in my Bible and everything. It's not even going to be relaxed in the sense that suddenly things that were wrong are going to become right, right? That God's not reversing his moral stance, that's not being changed, nor is he expecting less of us. I always laugh when preachers sometimes will say something about, boy, I'm glad we don't live in the Old Testament. That would have been hard to follow those laws. I think you must not have read the New Testament, because the New Testament demands, in reality, more of us and more maturity than the Hebrew Scriptures did. Because the Hebrew Scriptures allowed you, if you wanted, to put restraints and limitations on what you had to do, which is Jesus' complaint in chapter 5. He takes their interpretations of the law, which was always to restrain it in some way. Well, I know it said that, but it didn't mean that. So what? Well, the way they read it was to allow loopholes in the law. And Jesus says, that's not fulfilling the covenant. That's not fulfilling the law. We're going to have to do better than that. And that's what he commands us to do. So tonight, we'll look at the section beginning in verse 38, and we'll finish up the chapter. Someone would like to read verse 38 through 42? James, thank you.
"You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you."
Everyone does that, right? We don't need to talk about it. We can just move on. Is that... It's a challenging paragraph. It really is. So let's kind of look at what it discusses. First of all, what was the law under consideration? The law under consideration is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. If you read this in the Old Testament scriptures, you can find it in Exodus 21 in the context of restitution and reparations over damages, especially in dealing with slaves and in incidental damage or damage due to negligence. It's a weird chapter, by the way. Read Exodus 21. It has all of these strange situations it contemplates. One of them is, now if you dig a ditch and you don't cover it, and somebody's ox knocks them into the ditch, who's responsible? The owner of the ox or the guy who dug the ditch? So it's a set of passages explaining how do we deal with responsibility to each other in complicated situations, and the rule that's given that kind of guides everything was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life, blood for blood, etc. The idea being that justice was supposed to match up with the offense. This is repeated in Leviticus. This is repeated in Deuteronomy. And it was, we've heard it so many times, we kind of take it for granted. It was a pretty novel idea when they were taught this, because it's not how people thought. It's not how we think all the time. A story I call to remembrance, if you want to look at it, you can. I'm not going to turn and read it. But in Genesis chapter 4, we're introduced to one of the descendants of Cain, whose name is Lamech. And Lamech is very proud of his power and vengeance. And everybody knows not to mess with Lamech. And so Lamech says, if someone harmed Cain, God would punish them sevenfold. But if you harm Lamech, you're punished 77-fold. Right? So he says, if you punish him, you're going to get worse. Right? You punch me in the eye, I'll knock you out. It was the kind of attitude. You do me harm, I'll do you so much harm back, you'll know never to mess with me again. Well, in common wisdom, that makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, to be fair, a lot of national defense policy is based on that. If we're going to frighten you into not hurting us is one of our rules. I mean, it kind of works on a national scale. I'm sure it worked for Lamech to some degree, right? If you know anything you do to Lamech, he's going to do back to you 77 times over, that's a pretty scary dude. We don't mess with him. And so the law, eye for an eye, put a restraint on that. You're not allowed to poke out seven eyes if somebody gouged one. One offense, one punishment. Punishment has to meet the crime. It makes sense what that law was doing? You couldn't get carried away with vengeance and retribution. The offense had to match up with the crime. The punishment. I kept saying offense. The punishment has to match up with the crime. You knew what I meant. How did people interpret that, though? Even to this day, how is it interpreted? It's interpreted as if God is encouraging you to get as much vengeance as you're allowed. So I think if you read the law carefully, it said, don't get any more vengeance than this. But the way people read it was, I'm going to get every bit I'm allowed. I'm going to get that much vengeance. You poke my eye out, I'll poke your eye out. Okay? You break my arm, I'll break your arm. And no matter what, we're going to have perfect, precise judgment. And you hear this, well, I'm an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth kind of guy. And what they mean by that is, you harm me, I'm going to get you back. And that's the attitude that developed, which it ironically is almost the opposite of what the law was trying to do. The law was trying to tell people, stop, rein in your vengeance and retribution to a sensible level. And people took that to mean, oh, that means God says I can get people back, at least this much. And that's how far they went. So Jesus says, the way that you fulfill the law is through something akin to what we sometimes call pacifism. Now, I want to be careful with that word. I'm not a pacifist, and I don't think Christians are required to be an absolute pacifist. In fact, I don't even know that it works, to be honest with you. But more so than the prevalent culture, Christians are called to peaceful behavior. So when the culture says, let's do something and get them, the Christian's behavior is supposed to be the opposite. That's what it meant to fulfill the law. That there was an option, as opposed to 77-fold vengeance, you could forgive. That was an option the Christian had. In fact, if you want an interesting connection, in Genesis 4, when Lamech says, I'll punish you 77-fold, that is the exact same term in the Greek translation of Genesis that Jesus uses when Peter asks, how many times do I have to forgive my brother? He says, 77-fold, 7 times 70. So Jesus takes the vengeance word that Lamech uses and says, that's how forgiving you're supposed to be. Right? Complete opposite point of view, isn't it? So very challenging. Jesus says that the law is fulfilled by, again, some kind of more peaceful or pacifist-type behavior. We don't know what kind of limits. Jesus fulfills the law by commanding generosity and willingness to be used by others. I mean, look at the rest of that passage. Is any of this fair? Look in verse 40. Is that fair? In general terms, someone asked me for something and I'm now required to give you more than you asked for. That doesn't seem fair. it seems like you're taking advantage of me. And Jesus says that is the level of generosity that the Christian is prepared for, and in fact inclined to. If you are forced to go a mile, go two. Someone begs, give it to them. If they want to borrow, let them have it. Okay? It's startling because you read that, and what do you immediately think? Well, where's the disclaimers? Where's the rest of it? Because that's not going to work. And you immediately start looking for limitations on it. And there may be some. So, for example, in verse 39, slapping you on the right cheek. Well, okay, slapping on the cheek is not a life-threatening behavior, right? It's kind of an insult. So maybe Jesus means if someone does you a minor insult, you just bear that and go on, whereas this might not apply if somebody threatens your life. That would be a way you could kind of limit it and say, well, maybe it doesn't sound like, you know, what it sounds like when you read it. Because when you read it, your first thought is, am I allowed to do anything? I mean, do we have to let criminals just run loose in society? And that's what makes this, to me, a very challenging passage. Because I don't like going to what Jesus said and say, I know what it sounds like, but it's not that. Right? That's the opposite of what I'm supposed to be doing when I preach. So it bothers me when I have to come to you and say, I really would like to put some disclaimers on here that Jesus doesn't put on here. But I don't know, in some instances, how you could carry out society without some restrictions to this. Complete pacifism is the same as anarchy. If you're a complete pacifist, you also can't call the police because the police is going to use violence, so you can't do that. You know, you can't have rules because rules have to be enforced with violence. Ultimately, if you're an absolute pacifist, no violence whatsoever, you can't have rule of law whatsoever. It's impossible. So again, I'm not a complete pacifist. It doesn't work. But somehow the Christian has to navigate this, that the general disposition of Christians is not looking for how can I get the most out of that person, or how can I get back what's coming to me, or how do I get the absolute most vengeance I deserve. The attitude of the Christian is, how forgiving can I be, how generous can I be, how much can I put up with without acting out in a violent way? And that's the difference between the behavior of the Christian and the person who acts like Lamech. Is that a challenge? Yeah. I mean, it is a serious ethical challenge. My brother-in-law, I'm going to add him to our prayer list if I haven't already. I think I did. My brother-in-law, Ken Whittington, is on his second deployment overseas. And first time he was in Afghanistan doing security for a station that, as overseas assignments go in Afghanistan, it was not the most dangerous place he could have been. Nothing over there is safe, but it wasn't the most dangerous place he could have been. This time around, he's on a helicopter with a machine gun in what the State Department is calling Kuwait, which I think is government speak for, you're in Iraq, pal. So he's in an unpleasant place doing some unpleasant thing. And he wanted to know. He asks, Ben, what about the Sermon on the Mount? I baptized him before his first deployment. So this time around, he wants to know. What do we do with this in situations like that? And it is hard. And I tried to give him the best advice I can. And then when he gets back, he's a police officer. So in case he wasn't sure before, his life is fraught with moral difficulties, right, where he has to decide, how do we live by law and order in an age gone mad? Is this the way we behave? So it was hard. It was a tough discussion he and I had because he brought up the questions. I would never have thought, that's the odd thing, I would never have thought to go to him before deployment and say, let's talk about Matthew chapter 5. But you know what he wanted to talk about? He wanted to talk about Matthew chapter 5. He's concerned. So for 5 minutes of discussion, I'll let you have your 2 cents because I don't have much sense. So maybe your 2 cents will get us to 3. Do we unfairly limit this passage in practice? And when I say we, I mean you. Don't talk about, well, those folks out there, I don't care about them. I want to know you, when you put this practice into practice, when you obey this passage to the best of your ability, do you try to carry it out? Do you live by limiting it? Do you look for loopholes? Do we not limit it enough? Do we get carried away? Am I reading into it things that aren't there? What are the limits that we understand this passage to have? 5 minutes to solve the world's problems. What do you got? Jim, go for it. So Jesus will say this in another place. In fact, he already did, didn't he? In the anger section, this is verse 25, come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court. And there are ways to settle things without letting it go clear to where we're having to exact out legal justice and ramifications. That if we were, again, more tolerant of the mistakes of others, we were more apologetic for our mistakes. If someone needs a coat and there's a debate over whether it's your coat or their coat, you know, it's just a coat. There's a lot more important things in the world than coats. And so maybe that's the attitude of just a more agreeable posture would be the beginning of fulfilling this passage. I think that's fair. I notice that I like people to be more accepting of my apologies when it's my mistake. Now, they're rotten, dishonest people, but when they mess up. But when I mess up, you know, it was an honest mistake is the way we usually do it, right? James?
Yep. I believe says that the king does not bear the sword in vain.
So yeah, Romans 12 ends with vengeance is mine, make sure you give God the vengeance. And then chapter 13 starts with one of the people God does the avenging through is your government. Yeah.
And when soldiers came to John the Baptist to ask, what do we do? He didn't say quit soldiering.
Yeah.
He said, don't abuse your power.
I brought that up with Ken. It was one of the passages that helped me in thinking about it was he baptized soldiers. He didn't tell them to stop being soldiers. He did tell them to behave themselves. Yeah. Yep.
On the other side of the coin.
No, there's only one side of the coin, Jim.
We as Christians, I think, maybe have become too passive in the principles of Christianity in our society. When they are offended, we have a tendency to back away from it and say, well, let's live and let live. There are certain things that we cannot compromise on.
Yeah.
Under any circumstances, for any reason, we cannot compromise on those. And I think we need to be more straightforward in regard to some of those things in our society. And, you know, well, that's not politically correct. We've got to set aside that and say, let me tell you what is correct. This is correct. And biblically, we cannot ascribe to that. We cannot be tolerant of that. And I think we've let ourselves be overrun to a certain extent by some of that stuff that's going on in our society today because we haven't stood up against it like we should have.
One of my professor's favorite questions he would always ask when we were stuck on something was, what's at stake? What's at stake in that situation? So if you are slapped on the cheek, what's at stake? My personal dignity. You know, it's really, you know, right and wrong and morality and good and evil don't stand or fall if I get even with you for slapping me in the face. If I give you my coat, what's at stake? A coat. I know where to get coats. Okay. What's at stake when virtue and morality are under debate? Maybe the soul of a nation. I mean, maybe the soul of a people. Maybe history. It could be bigger than that. So I do think it's fair to ask, before we get geared up for battle, is to ask, what's at stake? Am I engaging in this argument or battle or whatever it is because I'm offended or I'm bothered personally and my my sense of whatever is at stake, or is it the will of God that's at stake? Well, that is the question that I think ought to hinge our behavior. In this paragraph, all the examples he gives, what's at stake? Just me. Just what I've got, and none of it's mine anyway, right? So, yeah.
Well, what did Jesus say? What was at stake when he went into the temple and ran the money changers out? Mm-hmm. What was at stake then?
Yeah.
I mean, could he just say,
They weren't actually hurting him any, right? I mean, there were people who said much crueler and more vicious things to Jesus that he let slide right off his back. When his dignity was at stake, he had nothing to say. When the temple's dignity was at stake, he had quite a lot to say. So, yeah, what's at stake is the question we have to ask. Good discussion. 43 through 47, in case we weren't confused, let's make it a little worse. You have heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Okay. So you've heard it said. Now this command, when he says, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. I don't know where the hate your enemy part comes from. The love your neighbor as yourself comes from Leviticus 19:18. I don't think he's saying Moses ever said, hate your enemy. There is hatred language in the Old Testament, but it's usually directed at moral conditions. God hates sin. God hates violence. God hates, you know, these are things that God hates. I don't know of any place that comes to mind quickly where God says, hate some people over there. And so what I think you're reading when Jesus says, you've heard it said, is not Moses. This is the way this rule had been interpreted by the rabbis and by the teachers. Love your neighbor, but it's okay to hate your enemy. If you want to keep your finger here and just flip over to Luke just for a minute. I know I'm cheating. I said I was going to stay in Matthew. I got on Lenora for it. Now I'm going to do it. But switch over to Luke chapter 10, 25 through 29. This will be familiar to you. Behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said to him, What is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, You have answered correctly, do this and you will live. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, And who is my neighbor? So the way this passage was read, love your neighbor, was to ask the question, yeah, but really, who's my neighbor? God seemed to mean, as you'll read in the story that follows of the Good Samaritan, people, humanity is your neighbor. But they were reading it as, who is my neighbor? That's the only person I've really got to love. So it might be my family members, my neighbor. The person who lives next to me is my neighbor. My fellow countrymen, my fellow Jews and Israelites are my neighbors. But other folks aren't. Samaritans aren't my neighbors. Gentiles aren't my neighbors. Publicans and tax collectors aren't my neighbors, you see. So the way they read the law, love your neighbor as yourself, was to quickly try to find a loophole in it and say, yeah, but who's my neighbor? Because if I can limit that, then I don't have to love them. In fact, I can treat them just about any way I want. And they did. Okay. People read that then as permission to hate everyone who wasn't strictly speaking a neighbor. God meant it as a broad, sweeping term, and they tried to find a way to make it a limiting term. Just love these folks, the ones that are close to you. Jesus points out how absurd that really is. He says, the most rotten, lousy people you know love the people they like. I mean, they like the people they love. They get along with the people they get along with. Tax collector, the greediest person on earth was the publican tax collector who had sold out to Rome. He even liked his friends. I mean, what command is that? Like people you like already. Well, that's really challenging, isn't it? Like the people you like already. He says, Gentiles do that. That's no kind of command. So what does it mean? Instead, he says, you love also your enemy. Now, it's interesting that he still calls them enemy. I think some interpretations of this passage have forgotten that. He's not saying Christians have no enemies. Sometimes we do. He says we love our enemies, which is more challenging to me. I almost wish he just said, you don't have any enemies, don't worry about it, because I know how to love people who aren't my enemies. But he says, yes, they are your enemies, and you love them, and you pray for them. And there's a practice. You want to know how to be more in tune with the New Testament, if you want to practice first century Christianity like we say we do, how often on a Sunday morning in a prayer do we pray for the people who are doing the most harm to the church here and abroad? I don't even know how you'd word that prayer. It'd be difficult, wouldn't it? I mean, you start thinking about, I don't want to say, Lord, help terrorists kill more of us. That doesn't sound quite right. But how do you pray for people who intend harm to Christians? I pray that they repent. Pray that they see the error. I mean, we could think of things we could say, but that'd be a hard prayer even to word. You'd have to think about that ahead of time. You couldn't just get up here and say that, because it's not natural. It's natural to say, God, take care of our brethren. It's very unnatural to say, God, take care of the people who hate us. See how it's different? But that's exactly how Jesus challenges us. He says that love extends even to the people who mean you harm, your enemies. He forbids favoritism. This isn't I'll pat your back, you pat my kind of thing. This isn't a deal where there's a give and take. Even favoritism, he says, that's not allowed. James will expand upon this next quarter when we cover the book of James will cover favoritism in considerable detail next quarter, where James is emphatic that Christians don't show partiality. That's not one of the things we do. And I think roots in this passage. So I'm going to ask a question, and then I'm going to answer it, and then you're going to discuss my answer. How about that? It's a little different this time. I asked myself while working on this, as a fairly typical American, mostly conservative Christian, I asked myself, who would I find it very difficult to love? And I made myself a little list of kind of who would be the hardest for me to love, and I thought, we'll talk about that. And so, of course, I'm a book person, so I decided to represent this in the form of books, okay? So I've got a whole slide of books. How about that? And this is just for discussion's sake. The book on the left is one called Christians at the Border. And this person raises the question about how do you love illegal immigrants? People who, by definition, right, illegal, by definition have broken the law. Okay? How do you show love to someone who has broken the law to be in the situation they're currently in, while respecting the rule of law? Now, an illegal immigrant would be like the opposite of me. I was born in Oklahoma, right? So, I mean, that's as much not my neighbor as I could think of, right? That's someone on the outside crawling in. How do I love that person? That would be challenging. The book in the middle, really throw you for a loop, Sally Gary, I've actually had a chance to communicate with her a little bit. She grew up in the Church of Christ in a very conservative household. Her father was very distant. Her mother was very loving, and she began to believe that only women loved her, and a little later in life became a homosexual. Since that time, she has determined that the New Testament does not permit a homosexual lifestyle, and she is opposed to same-sex marriage. But if you ask her, she says, I still have those desires, and I'm not sure what to do about that. So she has a program, actually, a nonprofit she operates out of Texas, where she gives counseling to parents whose kids tell them that they think they're gay. And she says, how do we talk to kids in that situation from a Christian point of view, not from the secular point of view that says anything goes? How do you say there is a right and wrong, I still love you, and there is a right and wrong in this, and how do we do that? And so she wrote a book that was fairly provocative, Loves Gods, Likes Girls. And it was her story as a teenager of trying to figure out what this meant. Does that mean that because she had these desires, did that mean the New Testament was wrong? Or did that mean she was wrong? Does that mean nobody loved her? What did that mean? And it's an interesting story. Like I said, I had a few communications with her. She's an interesting lady. And the one on the third one there I have not read, but I just saw it. I thought it was interesting. It, Undivided is a book you can buy at Mardell's. I've seen it on their sale rack, actually. And it's the story of a person in a traditional Christian home whose daughter converted to Islam. And she's trying to figure out, I disagree with everything you believe in. How do I love a person in that situation? So when I made my list, these are what came to mind. A person here illegally, a homosexual, a Muslim. These would be three people that I would find it very hard to identify with, right? I wouldn't think of them right off the bat as, that person's clearly my neighbor, right? My neighbor looks a lot like you. That's who I think of as my neighbor. How do we love people in categories like this? And remember, there's kind of two extremes. You have one extreme that says to love them means to accept everything about them. And that's not what the Bible teaches. But then there's the other extreme that says for them to be wrong means to hate everything about them. And that's also not what the Bible teaches. And so there's the struggle that Christianity has, especially as we're trying to reach them with the gospel. How do we love people who are as unlike us as that? That was my list. You may have another list. You may have somebody else who comes to your mind. But
how do you define love?
That's a good question. How do you define love? Are you asking me, or are you?
How do you define love?
How do I define love?
In these contexts.
I don't know if context changes any of it. I know, of course, our culture has a definition of love that's as far from Scripture as anything. Love in the Bible is putting the interest of the other person first and above your own. So if you love God, you put God above self. If you love your neighbor as yourself, you put what's in the best interest, what's in the actual best interest of the other person above yourself. Now, what's in the best interest of another person may not always be pleasant. We don't do harm. Discipline. We love our children. We discipline our children, right? And we let them know that sometimes they do things that are not right, and that's tough. And discipline never seems fun. But love is to pursue their interest even above my own. Jim?
I think God loves me, but I don't think he accepts me unconditionally.
Mm-hmm. And I think, it goes back to this definition of love. Our secular definition is that to love someone means to accept everything about them. And the biblical concept of love is quite opposite. God loved us the most when we were the least in his good pleasure. Romans chapter 5 says, while we were yet sinners, God sent his son. He was absolutely opposed to everything we were doing and shows us the greatest act of love. So I think that's the challenge for this moment in Christian history, is to walk that very delicate line, to continue to demonstrate love for people whose behavior is well outside of, it's not like there's close and far, whose behavior is outside of God's will as much as any sin is, and to continue to demonstrate love and not animosity towards them in the face of very often disturbing and damaging behavior that we seek to correct through the teaching of the gospel. Yeah. Jerry?
Two of the buzzwords now are tolerance.
Jim used it earlier, so it's not a buzzword.
Yeah.
Anymore.
And inclusiveness.
Yeah. I think it goes back to first century Corinth. I think it's at least that old. But yeah, you're right.
It's really prevalent in this country from the 70s on. Yeah. But I also think when you talk about who's my neighbor, a lot of times a lot of people
Okay.
Christianity talks about those who are like-minded.
Yeah.
Christ as brothers.
Okay.
And to the Jew under the old law, the fellow Jew was their brother.
Okay. Yeah, definitely the more harm they do to you, the harder it's going to be to think of. That can't be who God meant by neighbor. The people that have enslaved us, that can't be who God meant. God didn't mean Pharaoh. It had to be somebody else, you know. So definitely, yeah. Jerry? Other Jerry?
What was Jesus saying to those that were desecrating the temple when he cleansed it out? What was he saying to them? He said, I love you, or...
Mm-hmm. I was waiting for the rest of the question. Or there was a dot, dot, dot there. Was there?
Chip in a little bit.
Chip in. Oh, well, you're wanting me to ask the question and answer. That's not fair. Yeah. Love certainly does not always look like how our culture defines it, for sure. That love can be stern. As we said, we discipline children. Okay? Disciplining children is certainly stern. It's not pleasant. In fact, that's the whole point. If disciplining children was pleasant, it wouldn't work. So we do something unpleasant to the children to discipline. And so by the same token, yeah, Jesus demonstrates to get people's attention in certain ways. He acts out in a way that's most folks wouldn't have called loving, but apparently, again, it was his way of correcting something that was dangerous to them and others. Paul in Galatians has that statement, "Am I become your enemies because I tell you the truth?" He had some tough things to say to the Galatians that they weren't particularly happy about. But it wasn't a lack of love. He wasn't trying to be an enemy towards them. It's just that there was something they needed to hear that was for their own good. So yeah, love is not dishonest.
Was he standing for what they were doing as far as desecrating what belonged to God?
Was he standing against their desecration of the temple? Yeah.
So their sins, he was standing against and acted out. And you can even read it in anger that he acted out.
Yep. Yep. I'd agree with that.
It wasn't too generous with the Pharisees either.
There were definitely times when his patience with the Pharisees does seem to run out. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah,
someone was scratching their head. Don't do that. I will call on you. Yeah. Last word, Edwin.
Oh, boy. So two examples that come to mind for me is Jesus with Zacchaeus and mm-hmm. then Jesus with the adulterous woman. I don't think in either case we can say Jesus spent time with them to show them in a sense that he cared for them as a person.
Yeah.
To excuse their sin, yeah. Their wrongdoing. That absolutely wasn't the case. But the outcome of his spending time with them,
yeah.
In essence, we see there was a rebuke there. There was correction, there was teaching, and there was a proper response.
As always, I'm going to agree that Jesus gets it right, that he does walk that perfect line of engaging people lovingly and kindly as much as he is able, with notable exceptions to what's kind. Typically, with the worst of sinners, he is the most engaging, and yet never indicates that he condones immoral behavior, but in fact is very direct. He tells the adulterous woman, "Go thy way and sin no more." And he had the credentials now to tell her, "Stop sinning." I go up to a stranger and say, "Stop sinning," and see how far that gets you. Jesus can say that because he has demonstrated his love and compassion towards her. He's not an enemy. And so she has now to take it seriously. And that's somehow the church is going to have to learn to imitate that. Good discussion. Enjoyed it. Go home and solve all these riddles.